Good morning. I'm Barb Blutcher. I'm sorry that we're not talking about entomopathogenic nematodes, but we do have a new stink bug in Ohio and in the United States as well. The brown marmorated stink bug, Haliomorpha halis, has got its name because of the brown marbling coloration. It is believed to have first, because of it, although it's a good flyer, it's believed that because of its coloring, it was able to camouflage
species richness, which is on the x-axis. So what you see is that as we increase the number of enemy species present, we get a decrease in potato beetle survivorship, which is what we would expect with increasing enemy diversity and increase in pest suppression. But is this due to the sampling effect or complementarity? So if we look at the single best predator or natural enemy in monoculture, we see that the most diverse, the most diverse compositions do better than the single best one by itself. And so the sampling effect seems to be relatively unimportant, so we can focus our attention more on mechanisms within complementarity. And with our unique design feature, we're able to specifically target the functional groups. So at a species richness of 2, we have 6 pairs that include a single functional group. So only having pathogen pairs and only having predator pairs together. And we can compare that to 9 pairs that include the 2 functional groups. So having the pathogen with the predator. So if we look at the same graph, we see we have the gray dot, which is no enemies present, the crimson dot, which is pathogens. Predators are in blue, the pink dot is pathogen-predator pairs, and then the deep purple are multiple pathogens and predators. And so if we look at first moving from a species richness of 1 to 2, when we only add a species from the same functional group, what we have is no suppression of the potato beetle. So it seems that as we add more species to that of the same functional group, there's redundancy. But if we look from going from a species richness of 1 to 2, when we have 2 functional groups, we see the suppression of having both of the pairs together. To look at this a different way, again on the y-axis we have the potato beetle pupae in adults, and then across enemy species richness level, the gray dots are predators or pathogens present, so only having the single functional group, and the pathogen and predator pairs are in blue and crimson. And what you see is that as we move across richness level, that where we see our decreases when we get to having both pathogens and predators present. And so in summary, the potato beetle control improved with growing natural enemy diversity. This identity effects from the sampling effects appear to be relatively unimportant, and control only improve when these pathogen and predators are paired together. With that, I'll take any questions. Thank you. Yes.
Was there a reason why you didn't have all 6 together?
Well, with the design, basically, when you have 6 species, you have to design the rest of the treatments along having all together. And the other thing is, because the replicates are unique compositions, if we did the 6, you would only know about those six species together, that one composition and how they interact. Where here we have a species richness of 5, we have 5 or 6 unique compositions, and since we're looking at the richness effect, we're teasing that apart, so we're not focusing on the 6. But it would be a good idea just to look at how all the 6 would work together.
Yeah, it's just kind of that, I'm not looking at trying to take that apart, but adding it to the system.
Right.
Because, you know, it's kind of like, I was trying to figure out, well, yeah, how that worked together.
Right. Yes.
Was there a bus, one of your pathogens?
Yes.
Okay. That's pretty, you know, it basically could affect your predator, and some of your beneficials. How did you avoid that?
True. Well, I actually didn't avoid it because There were some effects where I saw, like, Taurasticus, which is a predatory ground beetle. I did see in some cases that they would be infected by Bavaria, but it wasn't a strong enough effect to, like, in the case of, like, intraguild predation, we don't see that much of an effect on Taurasticus to have it have a negative effect. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And yet you don't have the same number. Like, there's got to be some more weight when you have more combinations. So you have the zero all by itself.
Right.
And that, how much is that driving what you're seeing? I'm convinced with what you're saying, and I really
right.
like the combinations, using combinations as replicants.
Right.
But
well, taking out the zero basically doesn't change the line to be straight, if that's what you're saying with the regression.
Zero, just to make it more,
well,
you can see some variability in the zero, or
right.
I'm wondering about, like, how, if you did zero 6 times, would it always come out in that one space?
Right, well, I guess in this case, I mean, we're being more conservative in breaking those, well, collapsing all of those, because even within the species richness of one, we have two replicates for a monoculture. In that case, there is the variability there, but we end up reducing that into the single species. And I think with the, in terms of the control, they were, I mean, I can't say, I don't remember exactly what the variability was on that, but.
Just something that you
right.
could look at to be more, even slightly more convincing.
Right.
Take that out of the picture.
Okay. Thank you.
First, I want to thank Susan and Amanda for putting together this group of people and this symposium about caterpillars. And I think that, needless to say, Wendy and I feel that caterpillars have been neglected substantially, probably because you can't put them on a pin. I think that's the real reason why caterpillars have been neglected. Well, let's see now. Let's try this one. Doesn't seem to want to go forward. Amanda, you got any brilliant ideas? I was trying to... That's pretty brilliant, isn't it? Yeah. I was trying to make it go backwards. We're focused on who eats what in a tropical forest. Now, where is this tropical forest? It's that little yellow spot down there around the bottom end of the slide. And it's the same size as that yellow spot you see up there in the middle of North America. I want to emphasize that there's a lot of species packed into this little chunk of terrain. 4% of the world's biodiversity is sitting on the yellow spot. Now, to put this in a bigger context, that's the amount of biodiversity sitting in that big yellow spot up there. Now, the specific piece of the yellow spot where Winnie and I are doing this is called the ACG, or the Área de Conservación Guanacaste. And it's that yellow thing up there in the upper left-hand corner. And if you do the same kind of thing for that, for Costa Rica, 65% of Costa Rica's biodiversity occurs in this little yellow spot, which, if we go back to it, is the size of New York City and its suburbs, or Philadelphia and its suburbs, any big U.S. city and its suburbs in area. And in that area are four of the five major tropical ecosystems. The one that's missing is desert. So it was cloud forest, marine, we don't worry about marine caterpillars, and rainforest and dry forest. And this is what it looks like in a sort of 3D model. The Pacific out there is obvious at the bottom of the picture. Dry forest is the coastal plain. Then the cloud forest, or what remains of it, is from climate change, is still on the tops of the volcanoes. And then you go down into the Caribbean, rainforest on the other side. So we're talking about finding, or attempting to find, all of the caterpillars, their food plants, and their parasitoids in that chunk of terrain, as I say, the size of New York City and its suburbs. For linear things, it's 85 kilometers long, if you want some feeling for linear measurements. Now, when we started, this was sort of the view that we had. And this is the kind of view we have about caterpillars in most of the tropics. Most of the tropics, you step off the plane, you find a big green worm, you have no idea what it is, and nobody can tell you what it is. And that's where we were stuck. Same with the parasites as well. So in one sense, we were starting blind, you know, like landing on a new planet. On the other hand, there's an enormous amount of collecting of adults that's gone on. And you know there's a caterpillar behind every adult. So we know, in this peculiar kind of inventory, we know there's at least 10,000 species of moths and butterflies in that area, even though we don't know what they are and we don't know where they are, but we know they're there because of the adults. We know that there's that many kinds of caterpillars in the system. So we're doing inventory not totally blind, as you would as Audubon was when he got off the boat in North America. And the people who are doing this work, so Winnie and I can stand up here and talk to you about it, are parataxonomists, and there are 24 of them, and it's 24 careers. These are not graduate students, they're not Peace Corps people, they're not undergraduates on a summer project. They're people who are making their livelihood doing this. They're married, they have children, the kids are off to school. It's a life that they're carrying out, producing the data that we're talking about here today. And they're all, if you like, residents. They're all people who grew up there. Grandma's over here and mother's over there, and they married the girl next door, and that sort of stuff. We're not talking about people who come into this area. And what do they actually do? They spend their time looking for caterpillars, very simply. They find them, Ruth's up on the top of that ladder getting something that she found the turds on the ground underneath, and she's got the caterpillar there in her hand. It goes into a plastic bag, and it goes into a rearing barn. It's very, very simple. This is very low tech. And each one of those bags has got its own individual caterpillar, and I think all you realize that that's just an enormous babysitting operation. The small things go in bottles, and the tops are not screwed on top. The tops are loosely placed on the top, which serves as a kind of an in-between, a sealed and a not sealed container. You have to have them loose, or otherwise the decomposing material in the bottle often ends up killing a caterpillar. So little things in bottles, big things in plastic bags. And eventually something emerges, as you can see over here on the left side. If I can just scoop this around to there, you get big things like this, or you get little things like this. And those bottle caps up there give you some idea of the small end of the scale. We do not deal with leaf miners. That's for somebody else, another generation. And that then produces product. And I'm being very literal in using that word. It's an assembly line, an industrial level operation. And the product is adults. And you notice that every one of those bits of product has got a little white tag associated with it. On that tag is in fact, you can see them on there. You can see the individual codes right there. That's the voucher code that goes with that specimen. And on this bag, there's the voucher code there that goes with this specimen. So every one of those individual products has got its own individual voucher code and stays with it for life. And the parasites as well. But if there were 8 flies out of 1 caterpillar, they all get the same voucher code, because really the voucher code is the event of finding the caterpillar. And then subsequently, it gets another voucher code later on if we do something individually with that parasitoid. And then finally, there's the plants that these guys are eating. And these are worked on by quite an array of both plant parataxonomists and hardcore taxonomically oriented botanists. And as you can see in that photograph, we're not dealing with plants with fruits and flowers for the most part. We're dealing with lots of juvenile plants, lots of sterile plants. And so it's an enormous task of figuring out accurately what are the names of the plants that go with these individual caterpillars. But it can be done. And then the pin specimens go in regular old Schmidt boxes. They go in the overhead compartment on an airplane, and they're hand-carried back to Pennsylvania. As you can see, they're tied up with a string. That's no packing, just carried in hand with all the usual export permits and research permits associated. So after 30 years of doing this, where are we? We're at 335,000 records at the moment, 143,000 images of these caterpillars and the adults on the web now. That's about 3,800 species of moths and butterflies and about 2,350 odd species of food plants. So that's the degree of complexity. And that group of parataxonomists is generating about 35,000 rearing records a year. And they're doing the whole thing. All I get is product and quality control and try to figure out analysis and how to get the information out. And what Winnie does is all of this stuff as well. But she's also responsible, as you heard earlier, for the website, which we keep trying to be up. And incidentally, it's completely public domain. Your tax dollars paid for it, because NSF is paying the bill. As far as they're concerned, you own it. Now, it creates this kind of a process. That's a stack of events. Each one of those records is one event of finding one caterpillar. Now, many die. of disease. Many die of parasites, many die of maltreatment, what have you. And so what you have is all these records, and then some of them have a specimen attached. Some of them have a photograph attached, all right? So this is not starting with the world as a museum drawer. It's starting with the world as the living thing out there in the field. So there's this cycle. From you find the caterpillar up there in the new leaves, it goes into a lab, the paired taxonomists photograph it, they database it, ranks a record, it goes into a computer and goes out into your head. That's the loop. And our goal is, our attempted goal, is to find all the caterpillars in this place before we die and get them on the web. Okay. This is what the website looks like. You can put a name over here on the left side, for example, if you know names. Other ways, obviously, to work this website and get a list of the food plants that we know to date. Or you can get the photographs that go with it. You can get high-resolution photographs of those images, of the thumbnails you saw earlier. And you can get the adults that go with them. So this is the basic output. All right? So we're trying to go from something that looks like this, exceedingly blurry vision of the system, to something that's got a lot more resolution. Obviously, it could get yet more resolution than we've been able to achieve. So what happens when you do this? What happens when you inventory a big, complicated place through the lens of the caterpillar, not through the lens of the butterfly net or the lens of the black light sheet and all that? Well, the first thing that happens is you find a lot of things nobody knew were there. A good example is this Opsiphanes up there at the top. That's as big as my hand. It's a specimen, it's a species never encountered in Central America before, and yet if you go out and you find the caterpillars, I have never seen an adult of this thing in nature, only in plastic bags. It turns out to be a South American species, of which there were 5 specimens, all males known. Now we know what the female looks like, too, because we reared them from the caterpillars. The bottom 4 skippers that you see here were completely uncollected. Now, Costa Rica has been collected intensively with butterfly nets for 200 years. These 4 species all co-occur in the same place, were never seen. I have seen one individual in nature in my entire life, and we reared perhaps 1,000 of them in plastic bags. Now, the other side of the coin is this. These are common moths from a black light sheet, right in the middle of our intense rearing area, and we can't find the caterpillars. We know they're there because you get the adults all the time. These are not migrants. These are residents. We can't find the caterpillars. The one on the upper left, Atomaris gonascus, everybody, oh, I've seen that on the sheet all the time. And in fact, we've reared a whole lot of things that look exactly like it, Atomaris daphne. But it turns out when you barcode them and look at the two, gonascus and daphne are different. We've found a ton of caterpillars of daphne, none of gonascus. Obviously, the gonascus is, obviously, very likely it's in the very top of a tree somewhere, and we just haven't gotten to it yet. Now, let's look at some of the characteristics of the caterpillars that sort of leap out at you. The very first one that hits you when you're processing lots of tropical caterpillars is eye spots. They're everywhere. These are 3 entirely different families, a skipper, a sphingid, and a notodontid. And it just goes on and on and on. There are literally hundreds and hundreds of them. So you puzzle and you think and you wonder, and who's the selection for all this? Well, let's take it this way. You're a 3-gram bird, and you want to live 20 years. And you're foraging for insects down in the shady, dappled leaves, windy, moving, shifting, in the middle of a bush. And you come around a leaf, and that's staring you in the face. If you stop to look and see if that is a predator or an edible, you're dead. You're lunch. So you have to have the reaction, gone. Now, are you going to stop 2 meters out and say, I wonder if I was right or I wonder if I was wrong, and I go back in and look again? Of course you're not. The predator system has to be hardwired to say no when there's an eye spot. And I said hardwired. I didn't say learned. Okay? Now, if we just accept that hypothesis for the moment, that these predators are in fact hardwired to avoid this generic thing called an eye spot, what's the implication for that? It says a whole lot of things, because obviously some birds are going to be stupidly hardwired, some are going to be in between hardwired, and some are going to be, well, now wait a minute, I'm going to just back off 6 inches and look because I'm real quick. So there's a whole series of possibilities, but all you have to do is have some hardwiring in there and immediately have strong selection for anything with a dot in it to turn into an eye spot. Now, if you take that model, that way of going at selection, let's move on to this stuff. There are jillions of mimics in the system, and in the caterpillars. In the caterpillars, there are jillions of mimics. The thing on the left there Those are all, that color pattern, red at each end, a little bit of red underneath, and black and white on the back. At least I have at least 250 species of caterpillars with that color pattern. The thing on the right, you see all those spiny, urticating things on the right? None of those are spiny and urticating. There's a bucket load of mimics in here. Now, the traditional way of going at these color patterns is to think in terms of, you know, monarch butterflies and Lincoln Brower's blue jays. I mean, that's perfectly reasonable, and I'm sure that works in the system. But everything I see says in here that we have a big batch of predators who are genetically hardwired to never touch any of these sets. And immediately that changes the whole nature of the evolutionary paradigm for these color patterns. Now you say, well, wait a minute, that sounds pretty speculative, and that's just hot air. Well, look at the bottom row here. Susan Smith, 25 years ago, showed unambiguously that medium-sized tropical birds, grown up, never seen anything violent color in it, were hardwired to avoid ringed colors, period. Put the stripes on them, they take them. Put a ring around it, won't touch it. I had a baby owl rid the same way. Wouldn't touch these Ithomiine butterflies that all of us think are the things that are part of a learning mimicry system. It had never seen a butterfly in its life, and it would not touch a Helicoinine or an Ithomiine, and gobbled up every other kind of lep you can think of. Those things on the caterpillars that you see there are a great mix of aposomatic, classical terms, aposomatic and non-aposomatic. They're edibles and non-edibles. Look at the one on the far right up there. That's the same caterpillar 4 days apart. Upper right-hand corner is Pachyliocyces. When it's feeding on the leaves, 4 days later, it decides to go pre-pupal, walk down the tree. It's not a molt now. Walk down the tree, walk across the ground, and find a pupation site. Turns into a coral snake. That thing is not being protected by some bird who learned by through trial and error. That thing is getting away with this because there's a hardwired program out there in a set of predators. These are the predators. There's a trogon. That's trogon diet brought to the kids. How many ringed caterpillars do you see on that plate? These guys are living in a world full of brilliantly ringed caterpillars. They never touch them. Well, as soon as you have that kind of selection going on, it changes the whole nature of selection for color patterns. There they are. Now you say, oh, I've got to figure out which ones are edible and can the bird